Hey folks, welcome to the High Performance Human Podcast. My name's Simon Ward and I'm your host this week and every other week. You might have noticed a change a few months ago in the title of the podcast. It's now known as the High Performance Human Podcast. And there's a reason for that. It sort of embodies the way in which I'm trying to live my life going forwards and in which I'm coaching other people. So we don't just focus on athletic performance. One of my ambitions as I changed direction slightly on the podcast was to interview people who are high performing in other areas outside of sport. Some of these are clients of mine. Some of them are people I've been introduced to. But all of them have managed to create a balance between building a business, managing a family, training for their chosen sporting event and achieving their goals, getting enough sleep and recovery to keep the batteries recharged so that they're able to do all of these things to the best of their ability, and having a mindfulness that tells them when some of those plates that they're spinning are wobbling and they need to go back and attend to them. So today is one of those moments when I speak to a high performance human, and you'll hear me not just talk about their athletic achievements, but how they've lived their life to this point, what they did growing up, how they gained the qualifications that they have in whatever sphere, and how they built their business or worked their way up through the organisation to reach the very top. They're interesting conversations. These people make mistakes. They're not superhuman. They're high-performing humans, but they make mistakes. But the key thing is they learn from them, and that's what you need to look out for and listen for. Aside from that, I just wanted to return to the COVID-19 crisis. It's an ongoing issue, and it will be for some time. And it's really taught me the value of community. The SWAT community was intended originally to provide guidance and advice for people wanting to do triathlon and to give them some structure and training plans. But it's become more than that. It has become a proper community. And that's been emphasised by the coronavirus situation. Now, you might have read or listened or heard people talk about SWAT. And if you feel like you'd like to join the group, then we still have spaces. And there is a link below which you can click on, which will give you more information and where you can make payment to join. Equally, you might find that your future finances are challenged a little bit by this current situation and you would like to join the group, but you think perhaps prudently it wouldn't be wise at the moment. Why not drop us a line? Tell us about your situation, why you'd like to join the group and how we might be able to help, and we'll give it due consideration. We really will. I'd love to help everybody to try and join SWAT if I can. So if you want to do that, just drop down to the bottom of the page and you'll find an email link there for beth@thetriathloncoach.com. Okay, so that's enough of that. Let's crack on and get talking to a high performance human. Welcome to the show. The very first of my high performance human guests, Toby Baxendale.
Well, thank you very much, Simon. I'm honoured to be here. I'm especially honoured to be here as your first guest. I didn't know that was the first one in this series. So thank you.
Well, I think probably we have had plenty of high-performing humans on the podcast previously. I mean, this will be almost episode 150 now, so almost 3 years old. But none of them have been in the category that I've christened high-performance humans. Most of those people have been performing at a high level as an athlete, for instance. But the reason I invited you on and subsequent guests is that I feel that you operate at a high performance level in several spheres. So that puts you in a slightly different category. Maybe if we were doing a Venn diagram, you know, you'd be in one category, they'd be in another, and some of you might overlap in the middle.
Yeah. I think a lot, I've listened to some of your podcasts. There is definitely a lot of overlapping, with a number of your guests. Yeah. For sure.
Yes, and I've no doubt that some of the elite athletes that I've spoken to who are at the pinnacle of that career now will go on to form careers in business or in sport administration at a high level and, achieving then by the time they get to our age have achieved in high things, good things in several areas.
Yeah, I hope so. Well, I think if you're an athlete used to a fairly intense training program, and you look after all the other aspects of your life as well, you're by definition very disciplined. And one of the things that I observe most in life You don't necessarily have to be the biggest, the best, the most intelligent, the this, that, or the other, but just that ability to just stick with it, to stay and to be there consistently all the time, which particularly endurance athletes have, is a tremendously valuable skill. The tenacious person is probably the one to really, really watch out for. Not necessarily the pinnacle of the class, the guy who's the person who's right at the top for that particular moment in time for that particular thing, but it's the one who can perform just consistently day in, day out, week in, week out. Yeah. So they should. So, for example, the Brownie brothers. I mean, I know they have good intelligence, great academic credentials, anyway in their own right, but that dogged determinism, just the dog with a bone in their mouths, won't ever let it go. That should stand them very good stead in whatever they do post their athletic careers, for sure.
Yeah. Well, we'll see. I know that Alistair and Jonathan have got interest in business. I think Alistair actually studied a business degree at university, to keep him occupied part of his time, as if doing 30 hours of training wasn't enough. He wanted something else to occupy his spare time.
Yeah.
Aside from sleeping, of course, and all of his media commitments that he has to do on behalf of his sponsors. But there's obviously an eye to the future there as well, knowing that a sports career doesn't last forever, and what you're going to do afterwards. I mean, Alistair particularly went to Cambridge. I think he got the qualifications of a high enough grade to go and study medicine at Cambridge. So you can't get any higher level of learning than that, I don't think. And then after 3 months, he decided he didn't like that and wanted to come back to Leeds. So walked away from it. Really, there'd be thousands of would-be medical students wanting to go to Cambridge all over the country, pulling their hair out, going, "Why would you do that?" But I don't think it's been a detriment to him. No. So we talked about athleticism there, Toby, as you know, and as your coach, none of your sessions will really get going until we've had a warm-up. So I have prepared a little warm-up for you. I did send you these in advance. Because they do put people on the spot. So, So let's whistle through those quickly if we can. So you've carved out a fantastic life for yourself, as we will talk about later. But when you were growing up, did you have a dream job there? Or have you ever sat one, of an afternoon with a glass of wine or something thinking, "I'd love to have been an astronaut," or "I'd love to have been a racing driver"? Did you have another dream job that you aspired to do?
When I was a young teenager, I wanted to be an architect, and I still love. I mean, I absolutely love looking at buildings and thinking buildings shape people's feeling of place, feeling of being. I find them fascinating to look at and see how they work with people, and that's always been an interest. But I never took it on. I got sidetracked by the age of 16. Suddenly becoming aware of politics and world affairs, and then that took my heart, interest, and passions. And I always thought I'd end up going into politics. I was probably a rather arrogant, self-opinionated 18-year-old when I went up to university. But then at university, I had to earn a living, somehow, to pay my way through it. That's when I started. I was actually fascinated with wealth. Being from a poor background, I was brought up in socialised housing as one parent family, and just being cold, because mum couldn't afford to put the heating on, and things like that shape your early days mindset. And I just wanted to be rich. I was poor, and I knew if you're rich, you don't have these things. It's very simple and binary when you're a 7 year old and you start thinking about these things. So when I'd sort of come to life in London and started realizing that I'm after now kind of make a living for myself, I used to go to Chelsea, so I thought, well, that's where lots of rich people are. I mean, this is really how stupid it is. I'm, you know, just thinking, oh, I'll go and have a look at what rich people do. But then I kind of concluded that in the 80s, you know, a lot of those people in Chelsea, it's inherited wealth. So I thought, well, that blows me out then. You know, I'm inheriting nothing, you know, so what else? And I couldn't really work it out. Chelsea at that point in time was really a very bad place to be in for entrepreneurial culture. But I used to go to this nightclub, the 151 Club in the King's Road in Chelsea, and follow these, you know, lovely, beautiful, pretty heiresses in into there. And then I got talking to the owner, and he was trying to sell the place. He'd had enough, and he was having a hernia operation. It was all getting fairly grim for him. So I then said, right, I've got to own this. And again, I'm thinking back to myself, you know, I'm a 50-year-old man now. If a sort of 17, 18-year-old had said, right, I'm going to go and own this, I said, yeah, sort of tap them on the back and say, I'm sure you are. Perhaps you ought to concentrate a bit more on your studies and get some experience in life. You know, but then I didn't have any mentors or any fatherly role model at that point in time. So I just managed to persuade two people who were involved in politics at the time, they would. I mean, it's a bit of a sad story, really. I appealed to their more baser nature, because to get yourself selected as a parliamentary candidate, certainly in the 80s, you had to have a girlfriend or a wife. Otherwise, you'd be considered to be a wrong'un. Yeah. In that kind of jargon of those days, you know what that means. Yeah. Obviously, completely and utterly 100% politically incorrect. So I said to these guys, look, 100%, you will get women. Women will flock after you if you own this nightclub. And they put up the original money. Then I got 5% sweat equity, i.e. free equity for my work. And that paid my way through university. That's my first sort of baptism of fire into entrepreneurship.
Wow. So in all of these years that we've worked together, Toby, and we could talk about that coaching relationship later. Yeah. I never knew that your first role of entrepreneurialism was to be a nightclub owner in central London. And you must have been up there with Stringfellow and the rest of them.
Yeah, and if you look at me, and well, you know, Simon, you do know me. You have known me for 15 years. I haven't told you that, but I am the most unlikely of nightclub owners you could possibly imagine. Yeah.
Fascinating. I knew that these podcasts were going to be a good idea.
but there I was, you know, in the centre of it all, and it was a great baptism of fire and learning experience.
So who were the 151 Club? Now I'm not sure if I've heard of that. If it was famous, I'm thinking maybe of the 101 Club, where a lot of the sort of punk rockers used to hang out in the 80s.
No, it's not that. It's a small little club for the Sloaney people in Chelsea. But listen to this. I'll tell you a funny story. I've kind of forgotten all about this. You know, it's in my past. And then my daughter, when she was 13, she said to me, "Dad, did you used to own the 151 Club?" Yeah, and I said, Yeah, that's right. That was in the late 80s. And she said, wow, you know, so it was a real act of respect. And apparently her teachers knew all about it, used to go there as well. And it was like, he owned that. Whoa. And then so her next trip into London, we live in Hertfordshire, so on her next trip into London, she wanted to go and have a picture taken outside it. And I'd completely forgotten all about that. But she cannot, in her mindset, understand or have any conceptual thoughts of me being a nightclub owner at all. But I was a tiny shareholder, you know. That was it. The other guys were the main shareholders. But that was a baptism of fire. But of course, that was, I think, 88 to 91. And the 91, the Gulf War started, the first Gulf War. And that just killed, well, a bit like what we're, not quite as extreme as what we're experiencing now, but it killed the trade completely. And then I got out into a, foolishly, but it opened doors. I thought to myself, I'd graduated by then. I thought to myself, well, what is going to survive in this desperately bad marketplace? And I thought, well, these really, really inexpensive restaurants. And I got a third share in a restaurant on Lower Sloane Street, and it did sort of okay, but it was something that I'd always observed in the kitchen, and they were never ever happy with their produce that was being bought by various suppliers. So I used to then go down to the market in Nine Elms and for the fruit and veg, Billingsgate for the fish, and Smithfield for the meat. And it was then when I was saving £1,000 a week for the restaurant, which kept it afloat during that very difficult period, that I realised, wow, if I go and knock on the doors of loads of other restaurants and hotels, start supplying them, there might be a business here. And that was the start of the business that you're aware of. Yeah.
So I'm looking at the structure of this session, Toby, here, and I see we've jumped forward into doing the intervals before we finish the warm up. Yeah. It's fascinating, and it's very easy to digress into your business life from that first question about what was your dream job. So is that, just jumping back to that then, so I get some understanding. It would have been an architect, would it?
At that point in time, absolutely,
And now, do you have a dream job now? Obviously, clearly, you're pretty happy with your life at the moment.
Yeah, no, there's no, in reality, Simon, I do have a blessed life now. And, you know, I've got enough resources, behind me to choose what I do, which is a wonderful thing to be in. And not being a frontline CEO anymore, running my own thing, allows me to go in and support other entrepreneurs in their business activities. I'm delighted with what I'm doing now. So I don't think, I mean, I'm sure there could be improvement, but I can't quite think of it right now. Yeah.
On that journey, then, what sort of people spring out in your mind, or who springs out in your mind as being the people that provided you with the most inspiration? And is there anybody who continues to inspire you today?
Well, it depends what you mean by that question. If you mean the big, right, who ultimately inspires you, then I can give you one answer. If there's, on the micro level, have I been inspired by, particular individuals in my life? That's harder to say. I mean, the person who most inspires me is Jesus Christ and his teachings. Particularly, all the words that are said in the New Testament. That's the foundation of a Western civilization. It is basically spun off the back of all those teachings. Mm. On a micro level, I'm actually more inspired by people like my mother. When I reflect, as I've experienced more of life, and I reflect back on a single parent, the single parent family situation that I was in when I was being brought up in Acton, in the council place. She had three jobs at various points. The teaching job, the day job, and then a mixture of night class teaching and wine bar teaching. A tremendous work ethic to keep myself and my sister, and in clothing, food, and housing, and that self sacrifice is just an amazing thing. And I often note, actually, with poorer people or more challenged people, they tend to be more generous people. As well, so I admire those people, actually, the unsung everyday heroes of the world.
I've asked that question to quite a few guests. I have a range of questions, and so I just pick and choose a selection of them. And I'm surprised that mother, the parent, the mother, or mothers in general don't come up more often. There's been one or two guests. One guy said, yeah, the people who most inspire me are mothers, mothers all over the world, you know, for the stuff they do. Wow. And
a lot of sympathy there, actually.
Yeah. Okay. So I know this one was amusing you, and particularly your daughter, Toby, but you've had an interesting life. You know, you've gone from wanting to be an architect to owning a nightclub to your fish distribution and everything else that's gone since. So if they decided to make a film of your life, which actor would you choose to play you and why?
Yes, well I couldn't answer that myself. I find it very difficult to do those kind of real self reflecting kind of questions. So I pumped that out to my daughter.
How old's your daughter, Toby?
She's 18 now.
Right.
Yeah, and she put back, "Well, you look like Rupert Everett." Yeah. So I thought, "Oh, okay, that's positive. That's good." Maybe she's trying to get a bigger allowance off me or something. No, actually, she's not that type of person. But I really appreciated that from her. And then she also then put another one across for the cartoon character and saying, "Well, actually, you're more like Mr. Bean."
Oh dear! Yeah,
I think that's because I was actually some. This is, you probably have now had this discussion with you before. In primary school, I was put in what they call the ESN classes, which stands for Educationally Subnormal. So you can imagine that in the 1970s, ESN, and they actually had it on the door. ESN.
Just to make you feel worse about yourself every time you went to class.
You'd go in there, and they found me very perplexing because clearly I was intelligent and reading vocabulary and so on and so forth. But because I would now be classed as dyslexic stroke dyspraxic. And obviously there's ways and means of dealing with that through the academic or for the teaching processes now. They got their kind of heads around it, but that's where I think the Mr. Beanie element sometimes comes in, and also sport wise, Simon. That's why I've ended up being a triathlete, because pedaling the bike, especially with your thing with your feet strapped into them, you can't really go wrong, and running as well, and swimming, ball sports, absolute disaster, complete and utter waste of time with me. Yeah. So I think that's she's probably got a cross between Rupert Everett and Mr. Bean. She's probably got that quite right. So I'm glad I subbed that question out to her. But the my customers, when I was delivering meat and fish in my van, they used to call me Clark Kent,
right?
As well. So I was thinking that's the one. If I was really forced to, say it, I'd say, well, actually my customers did call me Clark Kent. So here comes Clark Kent. It's got the delivery. Yeah.
Well, that brings us on to our next question, Toby, about having a superpower. So would you have Superman like powers, or if you were to choose one superpower to have now, would there be something else?
I suppose the superpower I'd ultimately like to have is foresight.
Yeah.
Probably wouldn't we all? But then I've got to say though, when I thought these questions, if you really did have those superpowers, would life be worth living if you knew kind of everything about what was going to be happening in the future? So you could do things better and improve things and so on and so forth. I don't know. I think you might end up creating a whole new set of problems you can't even imagine. So
yeah. I've often thought about that. I've asked that question to several. I've asked that one most, I think, about the superpower. And I think flying is being able to fly yourself, around the world like Superman, fly above the world and get across to places quickly. But actually, if you extend out that thought about if you could fly, what would it do? What problems would it cause? I think somebody said, "I'd like to be invisible," but being invisible would bring its own problems as well. You know, people would bump into you. They wouldn't see you standing there. You'd get overlooked. You'd never get served in the coffee shop or at a restaurant because people wouldn't know you. For me, it's not to fly, but it would be like having a time machine. So like Star Trek, I'm not interested in, I mean, going back in time and forward in time is one thing, but having a time machine where you could go through a door here in the UK and then open the door the other end and you were in, you know, you're in Australia or you were in China or somewhere. So you didn't have to put up with all that schlepping around airports and sitting in a metro. But then when I think about some of the most interesting journeys I've had and the people I've met, they've been on aeroplanes. So you'd lose out on all of that.
It's interesting, isn't it? So I think when you really reflect on what that means, I think you've got to conclude that you're probably better off just as is.
Yeah. But it's an interesting chat to have one night over a glass of wine or two, isn't it? Things get more and more ridiculous as the wine flows. Now, let's go back to something that I know you get a great deal of pleasure out of, Toby, then. Reading books. What's the most recent book you've finished?
Well, the most recent book I finished last night was the History of Lloyd's of London. Which was absolutely fascinating reading how, and in fact, you know, the strange thing about Lloyd's of London, it reminds me of Smithfield Meat Market and Billingsgate Market, because you've got individual traders who start up in the late 1600s, you know, in a coffee shop, and they all run little insurance operations out of booths. And that's essentially still what they're doing today. It's a great it's a great bit of social and economic history, fascinating. But they did remind me very much of the markets, but the markets that I started my working life in. But obviously, the meat market and the fish market and the veg market is a bit more crude than the insurance market. But they all essentially work on the same dynamics, the same principles.
Well, let's come back to Billingsgate, because I remember we had some fascinating conversations about a couple of TV programs I watched a few years ago, and you told me about how they worked then. So I've written that down to come back to it. Let's just finish off on the warm-up then. So what about mentoring? Have you had people who've helped you throughout your business career and mentors, and who would they be? And if you could choose one person in any field, living or dead, to mentor you now, if you've got a free month and you could go and shadow them, who would that be? So that's really a two-part question.
Well, mentor, I've had no one who's specifically mentored me, but there have clearly been a lot of people who I've listened to. And I think the power of listening has become an acquired thing over life, and it's got deeper and deeper and deeper as I've gone along. And I reflect back often to times where I've ignored advice by people who have, you know, grey-haired wisdom when I was younger and more arrogant, quite frankly. And I do regret it. But there's people like, for example, there was a gentleman called Alan Lewis who formed. Actually, he was from Leeds Bradford area, extremely rich and rich and wealthy man. And I used to go and see him and talk to him about things and so on and so forth. We did some business together, and I thought he was you know, really quite ruthless and quite unfair.
But what was his business?
Well, he bought Illingworth Morris. In your area, which were mills, and then he had his own bank, and he had a whole conglomerate worth of businesses, and we did a tech business together, we and others. But I actually learned a lot from him. So he would be someone who had a great influence on my life. And then Luke Johnson, who was a shareholder in my company, I took on an external shareholder for the first time in 2006, before I sold the business in 2010. And actually, he had a lot of wisdom to give me, you know, a number of it I did listen to, and some of it I didn't listen to. But yeah, there's always people you can learn on. Listen and learn.
So that's Luke Johnson. That's Pizza Express, isn't it?
That's what. Yeah, he's always tagged with Pizza Express. But he's had a multiple serial entrepreneur career, and still does.
He was in the press a little bit not so long ago, wasn't he? Maybe just before Christmas with Patisserie Valerie.
Yeah, Patisserie Valerie. Yeah, yeah. Unfortunately, there was a scandal there in their finance department, which is appalling. But yeah, he's out of that now, and on to other things. Yeah, so there've been a few people, but you know, my biggest inspiration comes actually from philosophers that I've read, and there are numerous in the Western tradition that I'm familiar with, and then also the religious leaders. As I said, I mentioned Jesus Christ before. The New Testament is very important to me, the teachings that are there, and also in the Old Testament you've got the Book of Proverbs, which I challenge anyone to read that and say that is not relevant to today, right now, and to your life, absolutely right now. So although it's couched in the language of 3,000 years ago, unfortunately, the human condition has not really changed. So yeah, those proverbs are spot on, pretty much all of them. So yeah, there's a lot of wisdom contained, in those ancient sources that continue to form, who and what we are today. Mm. So I take great mentoring.
I'm going to jump on a little bit, Toby.
Yeah.
I know that your current location, well, you've got two beautiful locations where you switch between living, don't you?
Yes.
I guess you've probably chosen those, and you've mentioned earlier that you now have the finances to be able to make those choices. So I guess that those are the places that you, that you would choose to live if you had the opportunity.
Correct. Yeah.
Yeah. Do we need to tell everybody where they are?
No, not really. I'm sure people can imagine. I have a blessed life, so I can choose to be in some of the best places in the world.
Okay. Well, let's jump on to the next question then. So, you're in your mid-50s now. You've achieved a lot in your life.
Mid-50s? 50?
So, I'm sorry, Toby. I'm sorry. I'm in my mid-50s and I just assume everybody's at the same age.
Years off me, Simon. Can't allow you to do that. Yeah.
Okay. So, but you're in the mid-stage of your life.
Yeah.
Let's rephrase that. You've achieved a lot, but there must still be some things on your bucket list. I mean, you're an ambitious chap. There's always things you want to do, and you're always learning and wanting to find out about new things. So what is on your bucket list still, or places you would want to go and visit?
I think there's loads of places in the world. I mean, I started with others at a tuna business in Guatemala. And this is, well, unfortunately, I mean, talk about bad luck. It launched on, I think, April the 1st or something. So we're like launched.
April 4th.
Epicenter of coronavirus. But it's a wonderful initiative whereby we've got a whole load of artisanal fishermen and equipped their boats so they can do long line fishing, which is very sustainable, and have refrigeration on the boats so they can bring tuna back and get a proper price for it. At the moment, it's a waste of fish there. Believe it or not, it is chucked back into the water because by the time they've come back from their trip, it's lost its colour, and because they don't use refrigeration. So it's a very simple thing we can do to improve their lives there, the lives of the fishing community. And then being around in Guatemala, I went to this place called Lake Atitlan, and I was just absolutely blown away by the staggering beauty of the place. Several thousands of years ago, a volcano has erupted, and there's now a lake in there. It's stunningly beautiful, and that just made me realise, I've scratched the surface of the world. in reality, although I've had a wide and varied career so far, you know, there are these nuggets of beauty, outstanding, absolutely waiting to be discovered by me. Now, I'm kind of working in various places around the world, but I will take some more time off to go and do some more random exploring, I think. Get that stimulation of the eyes and the mind from some of these other locations. But yeah, it's a great pleasure to see, you know, levels of beauty that you can't even begin to think of here.
Mm. All right. Well, that's warmed us up nicely, Toby, and we've sort of touched on the first part of the conversation in the main bit, which was your at least the start of your business life. You'd got to the point where you'd identified that you were saving the restaurant money.
Yes.
But with the sourcing of the produce. So can you sort of continue that line of conversation and explain what happened there and maybe how you ended up where you are today?
Well, so what I did was just listened again. The power of listening is, you know, really, really important here. Just listen to what the chefs were telling me of what they were looking for in their produce, because I knew absolutely nothing, you know, zero about, you know, buying meat, fish, fruit and veg, etc. And then would go down to these, you know, market traders and then just basically be the mouthpiece for my chefs. So I appeared to be credible to these market traders. I am a confident person. I actually, that's one of my blessings. It can be a blessing and a curse, but more a blessing. I have oodles and oodles of confidence. So I could then, you know, really, really seem to be sophisticated, know what I was talking about to these market traders. And, you know, I wasn't messed about. So I'd get the best produce. That gave me a very, very good reputation. You know, the next stage was then to develop it into a proper business, which I did basically over a 10-year period. But it's an interesting lesson here when I reflect back. I had an absolutely perfect, to me, lifestyle business, which was turning over 3 million a year and probably earning a 7% margin. So you could earn some good money out of it in the 90s. But I was slave to it, and I was a perfectionist, absolute 100% perfectionist to what produce I wanted to, you know, to butcher and to prepare and give to our customers. But the business, you know, revolved around me in its entirety. And I had my own personal road to Damascus moment. 10 years, and after a foot and mouth scare, and after BSE, which shocked the meat aspect of the business, I then decided to focus entirely on the fish aspect of the business. And but the road to Damascus moment was, oh, Tony, maybe you ought to delegate a little bit, you know, to some people. And then I went in the next 10 years. I went from 3 million to 100 million turnover.
All purely as a result of learning to delegate.
Yeah, all purely exactly. That is exactly it. Just having the confidence enough to delegate and to let people actually, you know, run their own show where they're competent enough and capable enough, and give them that little bit of leeway.
I can remember. I think probably the first occasion we spent. Actually, was it the first occasion we went on that cycling trip to Spain?
Yeah,
back in 2005. But I think before then, we might have gone to Austria when you went to do the Ironman. And I remember spending a bit of time there. And it was on the trip to Spain. I think it was on the bus, either to or from the airport at the beginning of the end, where you told me about that moment where taking on a business manager cost you quite a lot of money. And you wondered how it was going to work out. And it was a leap of faith. But it then accelerated you forward into the next stage of your business, which is what you've just mentioned there.
Yeah, and it was incredibly rewarding, and I ended up building the largest fresh fish processor for the food service sector, and then sold it at the very end of 2010. So 2011 really was the first year of my kind of, you know, Toby Mark II new life. which has taken a while to settle down to where we are now, me being content with what I'm doing. Because the other problem is, and I think we might have discussed this before. I remember when you did your World Championship Ironman performance, that was the pinnacle of your athletic career. And then the pinnacle of my business career was selling that business. And then, okay, what next? You haven't prepared much. You don't do a lot of preparation for the what next. So it has taken a few years to settle down into, coming to peace with how I'm running my life now.
We're chatting as we're right in the middle of coronavirus and, the huge impacts it's having on everything in our ordered world and, how things will understandably change afterwards. But you've mentioned several things there that seem to have happened over 10-year periods, strangely. If we went back and charted them, we might find that these significant events. So you talked about the Gulf War, early 90s.
Yeah.
We had... we had the second Gulf War, didn't we? We had the Millennium Bug and all of the stuff that was going around there. That wasn't a bit of a sea change. We had Mad Cow Disease, BSE.
Yeah, that was 96, and then 2000 was foot and mouth. Yeah,
yeah. Then we had 9/11. And yep. We had 9/11 just after that, and then we had the financial crash, the big financial crash, 2008, and now another 10 or 11 years later, we've got these cyclical events where we seem to get into our comfort zone, everything's going along nicely, and then bang, it's like a car coming out of across running a red light and hitting you from the side, isn't it? And your world's turned upside down, you're spun around, you're in a complete state, you've lost your vision, and nobody knows where we're going. And then, so you've in that business career that you've outlined, you've seen over 30 years. Several of those incidents. So, what sort of things have you learned from those then that we could put into practice going forward from today?
It's a really good question. But and also, I mean, I just add one thing. I do read a lot of economic history, and this is a familiar pattern in general. Obviously, each event is unique in and of itself. But it does seem every 10 years or so, give or take a few years, there is a recalibration, and then that seems to be the mini cycle, and then there's a mega cycle that overlays that, which is whether it's industrial revolution or technological revolution, or then interruptions of wars. But the good news is that. These kind of things always happen, and the even better news is we always get out of it. You'd be an absolute genius if you could say how, and if you can predict these things, but predict these things specifically, but you can in general make these things. And I think the best thing, and the thing that I'm doing with all my businesses, apart from day one, is the concentration of just survival. But day two, you have to think about, well, there is going to be an exit to this, and how do I position myself in all these operations that we have, so that we can position for success and to make the most of the recovery? Because unfortunately, there'll be a number of people who would have been vulnerable going into this, who will fall by the wayside. And therefore that will give you your opportunities to then go and march ahead. So all of them are looking. All of us are looking at opportunities, and there are lots that we are seeing and we are preparing for. There is a success story in all of this. In all of this misery. There will be some very good things to come of it eventually.
I remember, if we go back to that financial crash. You were just preparing to sell your business, weren't you? Because I remember when we first met, having dinner with you and your father, and your father mentioning, yes, Toby's told you about his project then. And I said, what are the projects? And he said, yeah, the project. And this thing about building the business and then selling it, was it had a very definite start and an end period for you, which is seems to me, having come across several other people like yourself, that sometimes they get sucked into, I've built it this far, let's see how far I can go with it, and I can go, and then it all falls apart. Whereas you had a, right, there's going to be a very definite end to this, where I'm going to, you know, cash in, if you like, and move on to the next stage of my life. And your dad was articulating this about the project, and your whole thing was to sell the business, and 2007 probably was the time you decided that, and you were almost on the verge of it, and then boom, the financial crash. But that actually, as disappointing as it might have been there, led to opportunities like you've just talked about, which made you even stronger.
Yeah, that's right. Well, Simon, it's interesting you should say that. I did actually exchange contracts in 2007 on the sale of the business, but because I knew that ultimately, you know, you've got to get out. If you want to sell, it is pretty much all about timing. And we were coming up to that point where, you know, valuations were stupidly high and so on and so forth. And, you know, ultimately they're not sustainable. I tried to get it sold, but my buyer went bust, you know, in the crash. So that was the end of that. And, you know, I ended up selling in December in 2010. Now, I could have seen out another cycle, and I would have done better. But you know, at some point in time, it is you never lose by taking a profit, do you? By definition. So don't be greedy. And I took a profit, and it you know, opened up new opportunities in my life. So I'm content in one respect, but you know, reflecting back again, maybe if I was to have my life again, I could build I would possibly think about building for the long term. I mean, the problem with the business that I had, I built it very, very fast. Yeah. And you take on debt, and you're encouraged to take on debt because that's how you can build very, very fast. But you always, you know, when you're looking at it, you're always thinking, well, if this turns against me, then, you know, the house of cards is all going to fall down. That's why you sell. You know, and this is the private equity model. But, you know, the model that built, the Victorians did not operate on that model. They operated on building things multi-generational. Mm. You know, that was based on savings and thrift. And we don't have that culture in the Western system at the moment. We seem to have lost that. I would consider building long term now. You know,
you often see that in certainly in the UK, but do the Germans not have a slightly different approach where they do tend to build for the long term?
Yeah, they do in the Mittelstand companies. And that's quite unique in Germany, but also then the developing nations like the Chinese and Southeast Asian economies are more geared towards that. They have less of a debt culture. Mm. And when you have a debt culture, that does put a short termism in it. Mm. So the great names of Cadbury's, Roundtree's, Barclays Bank, Quaker Oats, these are not all family businesses, you know, anymore. Whereas their equivalents in some of those countries would be. Mm. And we have kind of lost that going on this debt fueled model. So I'm recalibrating myself, thinking, well, you know, actually, whilst I benefited from that model, maybe that model is long term for the nation wrong. Mm.
Interesting. If we go back to the high performance human part a little bit, Toby, my sort of analogy here is these circus acts that spin plates and manage to spin half a dozen plates very successfully on the little spikes, and they run between them, spinning them up so the plate doesn't wobble. So clearly you've been very invested in your business life, but you know, obviously there's a private side to you as well, or your personal life. Can you just as far as you're comfortable doing. Just share how that's sort of paralleled your business life from when you were at university.
Yeah, well Catherine and I, my wife, we met when we were 18, and we've been together ever since. And we were married when we were 25 or 26. And she had
sorry, Toby, you better remember that, because if it's 25 years this year, you're going to be in trouble if you get that wrong.
Yeah, it is 25, absolutely. 1995, yeah. So 25 years. We were together from 88 when we met on the steps of the LSE. And she's been very, you know, very, very supportive. She's had her own career as well. She had a career at Tesco. She's a high performance, lady in her own right, as well. And we have, I think, you know, we broadly speaking, I mean, we're not the same, but we have very similar values. So it kind of works. But to, you know, the sacrifices that I've made to put us where we are. We had our first child, George, aged in 2000, and you know, I still had 10 years more of pushing on with the business, being, you know, 6 days a week, sort of 70, 80 hours, sometimes even more. So the relationship with my eldest son is very different to, for example, for the relationship that I have with my youngest son, who was born in 2006. So there is a price that you ultimately have to pay. It's a good relationship still, but it's just very different in terms of the relationship with the younger one is much more tactile, much more intimate, simply because I'm around more.
And so that's Henry, your youngest one.
My youngest one, Henry. Yeah, so they're a different type of relationships. They're good relationships. Don't get me wrong. They're good and they're healthy relationships. They just could be. They would have been even better if I'd been spending more time during that 10-year period. But you know, there's trade offs in life, isn't there?
And what about your daughter? Your daughter was born in what, 2002?
Yeah, she's born in 2002, and yeah, I mean, I have a good relationship with her.
But, what's her name?
Charlotte. Yeah.
Charlotte. Yeah.
Yeah. As you can see, she she's the one I defer to help me out here. What the cartoon and the cartoon character and the movie character, whereas it wouldn't necessarily go to my eldest son. Possibly my youngest son would also be. Able to give me a good steer on that.
We've talked a little bit about their athletic pursuits. Which of those follow your athletic loves, if you like, and which of those three do you see as being the business heads going forward, if any?
Well, it's interesting. My eldest son is very, very academic, and almost asymmetrically so. But he suffers from the same kind of dyspraxic type of tendencies that I do. I mean, unfortunately, I've given this to all my children, have varying degrees of this. My daughter Charlotte, who's, you know, got a place at Oxford. You know, she's a dyslexic. So she suffers from that. She's very worldly wise. George is, as I said, in the academic stratosphere. But I think young Henry, I think he's completely well rounded and well balanced character and intelligent. Now he's had his little sweet round at school, earning himself anywhere between 30 and 70 pounds a week, which I was quite amazed by. So I think he's the one who's expressed an entrepreneurial interest and desire. Whereas I think my daughter, I think she'll end up being a headmistress or like that.
But one of the, was it Henry that was the talented rower as well?
No, George was, but unfortunately he did age 15. He did started the GB trial process, but he had that hip injury that Andy Murray had. Whereby the
labrum, is it the labrum? Yeah,
you'll know that the cartilage is split and that bone is cracked there in the hip. So that put an end to that, unfortunately.
Mm. You talked about the sacrifices, if you like. I'm never sure whether they're sacrifices or just choices you make. Choices.
Simon, sorry, just reverting back. One thing you'd love is that I attended my daughter's first half marathon last year in Oxford. And she did it. I'm absolutely amazed by her. She just, you know, at that age, just went did a little 12-week training program that I gave her, inspired by what I've learned from you, and then went off and did it on her own. You know, so wow. I think generally though, in general, people younger people are much more interested in sport than they were in our day. Mm. So I'm hopeful actually for a load of them. Those young kids they really enjoy sport.
There's much more when I think about when I was growing up. So just a few years ahead of you, Toby. Football and rugby in the winter. If you weren't big enough to play rugby, and if you weren't skillful enough with the ball at your feet to play football, you were a runner. But yeah. I remember riding my bike home on the pavement one day and getting overtaken by this guy, almost like Alf Tupper, Tough of the Track. You know, he was out running. It was in the middle of winter. He had his shorts and his vest on. He was a wiry character, and he sort of said, "Go on, I'll race you." And I couldn't keep up with him, and off he sprinted. But you never used to see people out doing what they call fun running now or jogging. Yeah. And so he was like a committed runner, proper runner, you know, and I remember thinking that those people were weird then. So, you know, how the world's turned as we are out doing that now. And then in the summer, of course, if you were into team sports, you played cricket. And if you weren't, you played tennis. And those were probably the mainstream sports that you got involved with at school. And then over the years, you've seen that there's been a whole load of other things now that have become mainstream sports for children to get into. So it's acceptable to ride your little BMX bike. You know, we used to do this. We used to adapt bikes and try and go over jumps, but the bikes would often break and collapse because they weren't designed for it. But it's acceptable now to call BMX a sport or skateboarding sport or
much more inclusive, isn't it?
So lots more opportunity now for children to express themselves and to be part of a culture as well. You know, if you're a skateboarder, you can have long hair and listen to particular types of music, and it's okay.
Well, some of the thing is being, you know, borderline dyspraxic and what have you. You know, I would be one of the last persons chosen, you know, for the football team or for the rugby team, the cricket team. Whereas, as you know, I've done two half Ironman 70.3 World Championships. You know, so I can't be that bad. But of course, when you're in that environment, certainly in the 70s, we've both been brought up there, and that is the only choice: football, rugby, cricket, athletics, and nothing else. But now it's much more inclusive. So people like me would get picked up, you know, in that school system now, and be put onto something more specific for what I'm capable of doing.
You're tall and lean, Toby. You'd have been the goalpost, wouldn't you, or the corner flag playing exactly. Football.
Stick that idiot in goal. That was the kind of idea. You can't do much damage there. And so hopefully if they kick the ball, it will hit him. Yeah.
Going back to your business life, Toby, you talked about, you know, working 80 hours a week and making those sacrifices. Did you ever feel at times that life was completely out of balance, and it was just like you were basically going to work and then coming home, going to bed and then getting back up and going to work again, and that almost like your family was sidelined? Or did you always manage to find time to spend with them? You talked about your relationship with George there, because you were so invested in work and then how those sort of relationships changed with subsequent children.
No, absolutely. So that was one of the motivations why I knew I always wanted to sell, because when you go on the 100% full on, I'm building this for success, for excellence, and so on and so forth, there's no kind of other way than being 100% involved. And that's what I say, unfortunately, to all entrepreneurs: if you really want to make the difference and if you really want to get this shit moving, you know, you have to push it bloody, bloody hard. You know, if it was easy, every single other person in the universe would be doing it. That's why it requires mass amounts of effort. But the mass amounts of effort does mean other things get blown away, you know, by the wayside. So I knew that, that for me, my personal choice, that there's a finite amount of time I'm prepared to do this for. Therefore, you know, think of structuring to sell a business. Yeah. So I knew that was happening, Simon. And that's one thing. And I also knew when I used to get ratty with people like my mother, who's only ever given me unconditional love in life. You know, when I used to step back and think, "Wow, I've just lost it with my mother. You know, this is disgraceful. You know, you have to go and apologize. You have to, you know, go and make amends. It's just a disgusting, horrible place to be in." So then I was thinking, "Well, actually, I'm not a nice person. You know." Doing this, therefore I need to change, and that was the only way. It was to either slow it all down, which you can do, of course, and maybe I should have done that, Simon. You know, this is an argument to say you should have just slowed it right back down, taken the growth pressure off, and moved it into a lifestyle business, or you sell. But when you structured it in that private equity way, you really have to keep up the growth to make it worthwhile. So there was only one choice for me in the end.
Yeah, I suppose going back to the plate spinning analogy, that if you spend all your time spinning one plate, the others behind you are going to wobble. I mean, that's the whole point about those circus acts, is you've got the crowd going, "Hey, that one there," and then you've got to rush over to it. So in that analogy, that would be you're spinning the plate, but you've upset your mother, so you've got to pay a quick visit to her to go and apologise, take her some flowers and a box of chocolate, spend a bit of time with her, tell her about your undying love and how you didn't mean it, and it's just, you know, you're not getting enough sleep at the moment, and then you go back. But of course, you've forgotten about George, and you need to go and spend a bit of time with George, and then your wife says, "What about me, Toby? You know, I'm sitting here at home looking after the children." And then, of course, while you're doing all that, there's your health, and there's all those other plates that are getting a bit wobbly, and so either you accept that in order to keep one plate spinning fast, other plates get smashed and broken and you have to repair them. Or if you're reflective enough, you can think, "Right, I need to spend a bit of time here. So maybe we can have a weekend away together. Or I need to at least make sure that every day I go for a walk to keep my health up." And that's one of the things that interests me, is about how invested you get down a certain path that you forget about things, or whether people have an expansive enough mind to be reflective on those things and pay attention to them.
Yeah.
Whether that reflectiveness changes as you get older as well.
Oh, it definitely changes as you get older and as you're a parent. I mean, I've mentioned my mother, and you know, when you kind of lose it against your mother, it's terrible. But you know, with Catherine, my wife as well, you know, she's given during her career and post her career, you know, she's given unconditional love to our children, and the amount of effort that she's put into this is just extraordinary. I could personally never ever I don't have the capacities to do that, and to watch that, and to watch that element of self sacrifice for others is a truly wonderful and beautiful experience. And then, you know, sometimes I've lost it with Catherine during those periods, and that's a terrible thing. So I knew I had to change, and I'm glad and delighted I did, and still trying to. You know, so we're on a journey, always trying to improve. You know, I'm definitely not at the final state. So there are other people, and actually in the admiration categories, I would put her as well, you know, in the admiration category. Just extraordinary women in my life that I'm blessed with. And it's often, as I said, it's the tiny, weeny little things that they do just consistently all the time that are actually the wonderful, wonderful things and the bread and butter of life itself. I'm not looking for any great big epiphany moments, you know, or any great big gurus to land down and be the answer to everything. The answer is actually right inside and around us. Enjoying getting more connected with that.
Well, that phrase that behind every good man there is an even better woman is you know, couldn't be more true, could it, in reflection to what you're saying there?
I confess, yeah, absolutely. There's a line actually in the what's it called, my fat Greek wedding or something, where the chap says, I am the boss of the household, it's what I do, and you know, you do what I say. And the wife says, yes, behind there, you are definitely the head of the household. I am the neck, and the neck moves the head. And I think that's probably right. You know, our better halves influence us, and we don't even realize it. So we're doing it. We're ending up doing their own bidding anyway.
You mentioned our relationship, Toby. We've been working together now. Is it 15 years?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm going to ask you if you can remember our anniversary when we first met. You mentioned so clearly that you met Catherine on the steps of the LSE. Do you remember when we met?
Yes, I do actually. Yeah, I went to the London Bicycle Show and bought a compu trainer off you.
You did? Yeah. I can't remember what year that was, but it was in the Arts Centre in Islington, a terrible place to have an expo because you had the main hall, but it was like it had a balcony around on the first floor, so they had a number of exhibitors on the ground floor, and then they had others on the balcony, and then there were all sorts of rooms off to the side, and then I was up some stairs, you know, along a corridor and then up some more stairs, almost like in a little sort of loft with two or three other people that nobody would ever find. So goodness knows how you found me. Maybe you got lost looking for the bathroom, but it just, I paid the same money as some of the other people. And then I got shunted off to the side here and we had hardly anybody coming up there. I remember that Try UK were up there as well. And maybe one other.
Yeah. I had to pay you via their credit card.
Yeah.
So my credit card to them, they were then going to give you the money because you didn't have a credit card reader there.
No, and I think that was one of the first exhibitions I'd ever been to as a CompuTrainer distributor. And I just sat there for that whole, probably Friday, Saturday, Sunday, hardly talking to anybody and thinking, what a waste of money this was. I'm never coming to one of these things again. I need to, you know, and then, well, if I do go to one, I need to be firmer about my position in the auditorium and everything. And then probably 4 o'clock on the Sunday afternoon, in you popped and said, I need to buy one of these.
Yeah.
But where I wanted to go with that was, obviously we've talked about business life, we've talked about your family life. There must have been a part of you that recognized that you needed to keep fit and to do some exercise as well to maintain good health and energy and everything else and try and create a bit of yin to the yang of work. At what point did that start, or was that meeting with me around the start of it?
Well, it was a couple of years before that, because one of my friends said, I'm going to do the New York Marathon. So I said, yeah, okay, I'll come and do that with you. Now, I was probably 15 stone at the time, so make two, three stone overweight. And I did started, you know, 9 weeks before training and did the New York Marathon, and it was an utterly brutal experience. You know, classic hit the wall at properly hit the wall at mile 17, and then basically drag myself through to the end. And I thought, hey, but, you know, all these guys do it. You know, what's the difference between, you know, me and them? And you're in some self-denial, you know, about yourself and your own condition. But then about a year later, I thought, right, okay, no, I do want to do one of these again. I'm not going to let this defeat me. Then the whole exercise thing became actually quite therapeutic. You know, because there is I don't necessarily see many people writing or talking about this, but I find it very, very therapeutic doing a long run or a bike ride or a swim at real time, almost like praying or meditation as well, to collect your thoughts and to rebalance yourself. So then I found this is actually helping my life, full stop, end of story. So yes, there's physical benefits and physical improvement, and you know, the weight started coming off me, which is a great thing. But then I kind of got, you know, probably addicted to it, and it's been part of my life ever since. But I knew, you know, there's more to life than just running. I mean, some people that it is their athletic life. So I wanted to explore other things, and I knew I'm completely useless at, you know, any coordination driven sport. So then I took up these other things as well. It's been a great journey, Simon. And, you know, for you, you know, I'm delighted. The reason why our engagement continues is because you're not just a coach, you know, in terms of, you know, do X miles and do this and do that physically. You know, you're looking at the holistic aspect of life, you know, nutrition, sleep, general well-being, work-life balance, a whole variety of stuff that we talk about, that we build, make sure we build into our program. Strength and conditioning as well as equally as important as going out and doing the you know, doing the miles that we do. So, you know, I'm delighted with it. Yeah, it's part of the fabric of my being. So I hope it will continue until the day I drop. I want to be like that guy, a captain, now colonel. I love it. Tommy Moore, they're giving him a promotion. Age 100. God bless him.
Yeah. We can't give him a knighthood, but we'll call him colonel now.
Yeah, which is superb. And, you know, I want to be 100 years old, being able to, you know, walk around the park.
Well, Toby, as your coach, I would say that the preparation for that needs to start now, obviously. Yeah. And for both of us, because, of course, if you're doing that at 100, I'll need to get to 105 in order to make sure that your program's on track.
Absolutely. Good. Yeah, you can't. No retiring for you, Simon. Yeah, we've got to go on. Yeah.
What's very interesting about what you just said there, Toby, about running being like meditation or being like praying, is that I did a podcast last week with a documentary filmmaker, an Indian gentleman who lives in New York called Sanjay Rawal. He has just completed a film called 3100 Run and Become. It's about the Sri Chinmoy Transcendental Run. It's a half-mile circuit around the streets of New York. So it's a sort of like a suburban area of New York. It's not closed off to the public. So you run a half-mile rectangle and they do 6,000 laps. They've got 52 days to do it in. So they have to cover about 60 miles a day. But as part of that film, he goes to visit several other cultures for whom running is integral within their culture. Visits the marathon monks in Japan, which is a fascinating story. But he visits the Navajo Indians, and the person that he speaks with there, Sean somebody, one of the tribe of Navajo Indians who lives on the sort of reservation area that they have now set aside, they talk about running being a prayer, and they run towards the sun in the morning. And when you run, your feet are connecting with Mother Earth. And when you breathe, you're breathing in Father Sky. Mm. And he specifically uses that about running being like a form of prayer. Mm. So it may not be something that's talked about very often, and it's probably a cultural thing. And the difference between Western culture and Eastern culture, but very definitely there are cultures for whom running isn't just about burning calories or training for a race. It's much deeper than that.
That's how I feel about it. And especially, you know, when you get out in these spring mornings, mm-hmm. the connectivity with nature and just a bigger thing is actually much more fulfilling, and then just zoning out into your own thoughts. And yeah, it's very, very useful for managing your life, irrespective of the, as you say, the calorific and the strength benefits or whatever we're focused on in our more Western orientated culture.
Yeah, there's a fair amount of research that's shown that being connected to nature, being out in the woods, running through the trees, listening to the birds chirp, or feeling the leaves and the branches crack under your feet, and just having the trees swaying in the breeze, is amazing for mental health. You know, and I did a podcast with Malcolm Brown, and, you know, we've talked about this before. Malcolm, for those listeners who aren't aware of him, was, you know, before he retired, a very high-level running coach. He was involved with Paula Radcliffe and Kelly Holmes, and then he transitioned to triathlon because he was living in Leeds, and he got involved with the Brownlees and steered them to their Olympic medals. And then he was involved with Vicky Holland and Non Stanford and all of the other performance triathletes there. But we did a podcast about running, and one of the questions I asked him was, what do you need to do to be a good runner? And he didn't tell me about what times you had to do or what interval sessions you had to do each week. He said, you know what? The very first thing, Simon, is to absolutely relish the thought of running, to just enjoy the process of running, to be free, to not run to your watch or a heart rate monitor or a pre-assigned time, is to just enjoy the whole aspect of running. And it's not until you can have that you can then really progress on to performance and getting your ultimate performance. You have to love it. And if you listen to the Brownlees talk, you know, they run every day, or at least they did. They may not run quite as much now, but they used to run every day, and they would go into the woods, and they do it because they love it. They don't do it because it's going to lead to medals. They do it because they love it. And because they've got the love, that's led to the medals.
Yeah. Well, I say amen to that, Simon. I really would. The binning of watches and measuring this and measuring that has actually made me a much better athlete, much better sportsman, for a whole variety of reasons. Just getting that connectivity with nature, with myself, and zoning off, and actually letting your body just perform. And listening to your body rather than listening to your watch or your heart rate. I mean, I know these things have their role and their place, but the obsession, which I think was wrong, basically, is wrong.
Well, over the years, and that's maybe because of, you know, there would have to be some investment in this from yourself, but maybe it's you know, my encouragement as well, as I've changed my outlook. And you mentioned the holistic outlook of coaching. Is, I think, Primal Endurance might have been a catalyst for this, that book that I read several years ago. It's interesting to me now that I hear other coaches talking about the methods and philosophies in that book. And I think, yeah, actually, do you know what? I think a lot of that might have come from me, because I read that book and I started talking about it in some of my blog posts, and I gifted it to quite a lot of people as a present, including yourself.
Yeah.
And we talked about nose breathing. We talked about math method of training. We talked about not running to gadgets. We talked about training by feel. A totally different approach, which is sort of swimming against the current in the current trends, isn't it? Is everybody has to have stuff recorded on Strava, uploaded to social media, immediate signs to tell your friends, getting kudos and thumbs up from people. And yeah, that sort of that pressure of what other people think and, you know, what other people see takes away the love of all the stuff you've just talked about.
Yeah, exactly. And well, that Primal Endurance book, if you were going to ask me about one of the most influential books, it is actually one of the most influential books of my lifestyle. I'd put that in the top 10 books.
Wow. Yeah, and I know that you've read some very very influential books, Toby, over your life.
Yeah, well, that one, you know, I have, and I've read most of the great books in our philosophical tradition. That one has actually changed my life. Full stop. End of story. You know, so there was a moment pre Primal Endurance, and there was a moment after Primal Endurance.
Excellent. Yeah. I shall contact Brad Cairns and let him know that amazing fact.
PE, post PE and pre PE, anti PE, whatever it is. Yeah. So very good, Simon. And that's it's a great thing you bring into my life, is those kind of other things that I'm not necessarily looking out for myself. But you've picked up a few gems there along the way.
Do you, just going back to those times in your life, Toby, when you were so engaged in building that fish distribution business, did you talked about you know, recognizing that you'd upset your mom, or perhaps you got a bit irritable with Catherine. I know that during those days you didn't used to sleep a lot. At least as a coach, I was constantly amazed at how little sleep you used to be able to, I'll say, survive on, because I definitely don't think your health was thriving on 5 hours sleep a night, but you seem to be able to survive on 5 hours sleep a night. And I'm sure that occasional lack of sleep was what caused the irritability, because I know I've seen that in myself when I get when I get tired, that I get irritable. Were you able to recognize moments when things were getting out of balance before it resulted in those sort of high temperature moments, or was it when you lost it with somebody that you recognized
it's post I'd never knowingly lose it on someone, especially loved ones. Post reflection, just thinking, God, that was phenomenally stupid, deeply insensitive, and unacceptable behavior. So then to go back and, you know, try and correct it. And when you've had a few of those incidents, then you realize it's too much. Yeah. But look, I am blessed, Simon, with not requiring, you know, huge amounts of sleep. But what I can say though is it's the quality of the sleep is the most important thing. You know, I'm very happy on five or six hours. But it's got to be proper, you know, zone out, boom, you're out, deep, rich, sleep. And I think I noticed when I have my one rest day, it's a slightly lighter sleep in the evening. So the exercise is making sure I actually have those deep sleeps as well, deep, proper, rich sleeps. But then I get up, and then I'm absolutely fine and can have a fully enriching day. Which is wonderful. So I think I'm just sort of blessed in that in that respect, in not requiring lots of it. What I do require is quality. So the blacking out of the room, the silence, you know, in the room and the surrounding areas. And it's, we are in the countryside. We're in the middle of nowhere. So that helps a lot. But I take a lot of sort of care and attention on doing proper blackout, and you can sleep wonderfully.
Do you have a lot of the sleep experts talk about having a pre-sleep ritual? Do you have something like that that you do in the while you're still awake, but as a preparation for going to sleep?
You'd give me 2 out of 10 probably on that, unfortunately, because I'm still clearing off emails or having a quick check on social media before I go to bed. And so, of course, I don't advise my children to do that, and the younger ones, I have more influence over. You know, you can. I'm preaching something different to what I'm practicing. So no. I'm a bit of a hypocrite, but
don't let them listen to this podcast. Yeah. Do you sleep with the windows open? I mean, living in the countryside, and one thing I've noticed recently with the less, I don't have any main roads near my house. I can hear a constant sort of low level hum from the main road, which is about 200 or 300 meters away. But I have noticed with the huge reduction in traffic, that the morning song from the birds is so much more pronounced, and I do tend to have my windows ajar at night, so I can hear that sound now. I wake up about 4:30 momentarily, and then I lie there listening to the birds tweeting and trying to work out which one's which, and listening to some of them repeating their little song, and then when I go out walking or running later on, I can pick up, oh, that's the blackbird, that one, because I can see it in the tree and stand and listen to it for a bit. Do you enjoy that?
Occasionally, yeah, but my wife suffers from hay fever, so in probably a few weeks' time that will all stop for a while. When we're abroad in hotter climate, then yes, as well. It's not lovely just to be, again, it's more connection with your environment.
Do you you talked about perhaps not checking in with yourself. Do you reflect and check in with yourself a bit more now about your life and your balance and everything?
More, yes, more, absolutely, more so now. Yeah.
How often would you? Yeah, do
but not
that?
In a, so. No, the question of who would play you in a movie? If anyone was dumb enough to do a movie about my life, you know, it's a bit of an embarrassing question, saying, well, who would you choose to represent you, to act you? No, I think that's a bit narcissistic. But I'm very happy to reflect about my inner self, and my inner qualities, right, and where I'm failing, you know, as a person, where I'm succeeding, you know, and am I trying to live, you know, up to the standards of the gospel? Yes, I am. But do I fail? Yes, I do. And how do I try and, you know, improve myself? And I will do one or two stupid things today, and then I will you know, end up reflecting upon those and try and make sure I don't bloody do them again. Don't be an idiot. Yeah. But that's the time when you can do reflect. I do that in prayer, and I do that in I do that when I'm out on long runs and things like that, where you can get into your kind of issues. Yeah.
Mm. What about relaxing then? Anything else other than running and exercise? Because I know training sort of like your daily discipline that you do first thing in the morning, isn't it?
Yeah.
You're sort of part of the 5 a.m. club, really.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. But it is, in one respect, I mean, I know I'm getting exhausted and sort of, challenge myself and so on and so forth, but it's actually quite relaxing. That might well be a paradox, but I find that aspect of my life relaxing. In the more conventional sense, I absolutely love the pleasure of being able to go and sit in my favourite armchair, and I read the weekly periodicals, New Statesman, and the from the left wing side, and the Spectator from the right wing side, and then take a Sunday paper. I'm also reading a Mexican paper every day as well, so I'm learning Spanish because of the business interests I've got out there, and that's actually very relaxing doing that. And then you know, the good old fashioned humble walk, you know, just a walk through the local woods, just not a care in the world, no real purpose other than just to walk. Is a wonderful pleasure.
I'm blessed to use one of your words there, Toby, that where I live on this Leeds side of Leeds Liverpool Canal, in either corner I can go and walk around woods, and I've loved recently walking through. We haven't had any rain for the last month until the last couple of days, so everything's dried out. It's been nice and sunny. I think the weatherman said it was the sunniest April on record that we've just experienced, and the bluebells are coming out, the birds, I was watching the blackbirds chasing off the magpies yesterday. Clearly they're defending a nest, you know. The squirrels are out, the woodpecker's out pecking his way into the trees and storing his booty up there, and it's been great just running through but stopping to listen. Where's the woodpecker? You know, I've only seen him once in the years, you know, being able to sort of move around and get close to his sound and see him on the tree. But it's nice to listen to the woodpecker and to be able to notice those things. And I guess if I was running with headphones in, a lot of that would bypass me.
Yeah.
Which is something else, again, about being connected to nature, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love those little moments, just walking around here, just walking through the bluebell wood and having that sensation on your eyes.
Yeah.
You know, it's phenomenal. You can. It's that nature. Yeah, fiction wouldn't be better than it. And I often find that in life. If you think about the story of our Prime Minister as well, you know, he gets coronavirus. He has a near death experience. He then does his resurrection speech on Easter Sunday. Spookily, yeah, and then he disappears off into wherever, you know. He has his ascension moment, we don't hear from him, and then he arrives back for a day, and then bang, there's a premature baby, and he's off again. I mean, you couldn't make that up, could you? I mean, you know, that's real drama. Mm. It's better than fiction. Much better than fiction, and nature's better than anything you can make up. So
yeah,
I'm a big, big fan of real life, actually. Yeah.
What? So you're very ordered now. You have all of these things that you do every day, Toby, as well as your business interests. Do you have a ritual or a timetable that you set out each week of things that you need to do? And do you try to do them on the same times each day, or is it more reactive?
Well, there's certain things that are sort of block ends, if you like, that are set in stone. So, you know, I will, as you say, you know, 5 o'clock in the morning, whatever, sometimes even earlier, I do my sport. That sets me up for the basis of the day. I will then do my prayers, and I'll then do my learning a little bit of Spanish. This is before the world even gets moving, yeah. And then I'm into the business phase, and that's the normal working hours, which have a dynamic of their own. And then you know, I'm into the rest and recreation stage, if you like, with me being a father and attending to my family in the late afternoon stroke early evening. Mm. Yeah, so I suppose that's the dynamic.
Would you have a perfect week?
No week's nah. Perfect, is it? You know, I'm a sinning human being, so you know, I always do some idiotic thing. You know, that I think, oh bloody hell, I should have done that better. Note to self, don't do that again, you Wally. Yeah.
Yeah, until the next time. let's just summarize then, Toby. So as you've got older and wiser and more reflective, what things have become more important to you and what things have become less important? You know, I mean, I remember probably we did a little podcast 12 years ago because I was asking you about how you treated your working life and the importance of exercising that as we approached the financial, or as we were in the financial crash, if you can remember. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that stood out then was you basically got rid of all the fluff, you called it, out of your life. So no social media, no TV. So all of those things that eat up time that people seem to think are essential. And when they say, I'm too busy, I haven't got time for that, but they've still got several hours a day that gets assigned to those tasks.
Yeah, well, I still do that, Simon. That kind of fluffiness, and that's why, you know, celebrity culture, absolutely zero interest in whatsoever. A lot of popular culture passes me by. You know, these things. I think the things that I'm interested in is in 100 years' time, will any of these things be remembered and spoken about? And the answer is emphatically no. Yeah, I'm interested in those real quality things that are truly excellent. I'll pursue those. It's interesting. There was a Harvard professor. He's a literary professor. I think his name's Paul Cantor. I think that was his name. And I listened to him. He came to an economics. He had an economics interest, and he's at an economics conference. And he was saying about every century, as every century goes by, there are about 400 or 500 things that actually will be spoken about in the next century from that century. And we're talking about some of them today. Like if you listen to a piece of Mozart, you know, or Beethoven. I mean, just extraordinary one-off, you know, off-the-scale talent, yeah? And they will be listened to, for the rest of humanity. That's excellence. And you're rarely, 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 rarely do you see excellence. And that's the kind of stuff that I'm much more interested in absorbing my time, spending my time with, any of my free time with, is things of just exceptionalness. My mother sent me Raymond Tallis's Spare Me an Alien, and I was listening to it. It's 40 voices singing, no musical instruments whatsoever. And it completely and utterly blew my mind away, you know. That again is just a unique piece of our history. But there's probably not one artist in popular culture today who'd be spoken about, you know, 400 years time. So, you know, I spent my time trying to find those little nuggets.
So going back to my original question, then, as you've got older and wiser, what parts of your life have assumed more importance and which ones less importance?
Well, the spiritual aspect of actually connecting with something infinitely greater than myself, and actually encouraging me to think about more than anything other than just my own particular little spot on this planet, which the spiritual side of things invariably makes you do. So that's been very rewarding. And just family. I mean, one of the positives of confinement, you know, under coronavirus, is I've got all the family around me. And that's actually quite a lovely experience. We probably won't be together again, you know, in our entirety, in normal circumstances, probably until Christmas. But to have everyone, you know, around is great. Yeah.
Exercise and health and nutrition. I mean, we talked about primal endurance, but we haven't really talked about how your nutrition changed there. Cause I know you did make some changes with your diet at that point as well, didn't you?
Yeah. So, you're right to remember that Paul Clayton, of the book Health Defense.
Yes.
Dr. Paul Clayton. And that was actually probably earlier, 2005, 2006, when I confronted my, you know, reasons why I was getting colds so often, you know, because I was immunosuppressing. But then, which is quite common with athletes, but then being able to overcome that almost completely by changing diets that was another sort of revelationary moment. So you should put that book as well in the top 10 sort of change books that had an impact on life as well. I'd thoroughly recommend it to anyone.
We should get Paul Clayton onto the podcast. I think he would be an interesting person to speak with.
Yeah, for sure.
Cool. Well, Toby, it's been fascinating. Thank you so much for sparing some time. Some part of your midday really now, isn't it? 9:30 in the morning. I was recalling how somebody put me onto a video, James Corden. You've probably heard of James Corden. Even though you shield yourself from the TV, you'll have heard of James Corden. And Mark Wahlberg, who is a well-known actor in the United States. And Mark Wahlberg has this, what he calls the 5 a.m. club. So James Corden films this bit where he goes to work out with Mark Wahlberg, at his gym at 5 o'clock, stupid o'clock he calls it. And he talks, he's getting up and he's playing to the camera. He's saying, look, this is Mark Wahlberg's day. He's already been up and he's got up at 4 a.m. and he's prayed and he does this. And Mark Wahlberg has this really scripted day, you know, pray here, meditate there, work out, do emails, have breakfast with my family, have lunch with my family, do this, in bed by 8 o'clock so he can get up, you know, because he seizes the day and gets on with it. It was really interesting because Mark Wahlberg always plays, you know, drug barons or special forces soldiers or twisted cops, you know, bucking the system. And yet his real life character is actually quite spiritual and, not at all like he's, maybe doesn't seem to be at all like his the actors or the characters he portrays in his films.
Well, he must have a huge skill base to be able to do that then, because a lot of people just end up playing a version of themselves, but he's clearly playing something that's completely different, shows great skill.
We'll put the link to that on. It's quite funny just seeing James Corden. He's half asleep as he's going in there. And of course, he's making it a bit of a comedy. And Mark Wahlberg's trying to work out really hard. I think he says that nobody should ever get up at a time when it says a 4 in the day. Cool. Well, listen, Toby, I know you've got lots of other stuff to get on with today. So thank you so much for sharing some time with us and giving us an insight into the life of a high-performance human. And how it is possible to spin those plates, but I think that's the key skill, isn't it? Is that it requires a bit of reflection occasionally to be able to do that successfully. So thank you.
Well, Simon, a great pleasure. I'm deeply honoured to be your first guest on this series, and I wish it well. And listen to it with great interest, because I'm sure I can learn, you know, oodles of things from other people as well.
Well, if we're lucky, Toby, in 200 years, this might be one of those 400 things that people are still talking about.
No chance.
All right. Thanks so much, Toby, again. Yeah. Enjoy the rest of your week.
Yeah, cheers then, Simon. God bless.
Bye for now.
Right then, that's a wrap for this week. Thanks again for listening. As always, I appreciate that you have plenty of choice out there in podcast land, so it does mean an awful lot to me when you come back regularly. If you enjoyed the podcast, please could you hop onto iTunes or Podbean and leave a rating and a comment if you can. Apparently, it's really good for the ratings, although to be absolutely honest with you, I have no idea how they work these things out. If you like the way I roll and you find some synergy with my approach to life and sport, maybe be interested in joining my SWAT Inner Circle training group. If you are, please just email beth@thetriathloncoach.com for more details. You can also use that email address to ask for my special free gift, which I have for you, which are my top 25 tips on how to be a high-performance human. Okay, that's all for this week. I'll be back next week with another great guest. So for now, enjoy the rest of your week.